Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Journalist Glenn Greenwald brought to light the documents leaked by Edward Snowden. Today, Greenwald talks about Snowden, civil liberties, government spying, and why the mainstream news media are a national disgrace. I hope you'll stay tuned. Reading the newspapers, I'm getting a bad case of déjà vu, I'm afraid. I noticed that the so-called mainstream press is determined to pretend that we have another Cold War on our hands, with our traditional Cold War enemy, Russia in general, and its head of government in particular. Khrushchev then, Putin now. I noticed this in the months ahead of the Olympics. Every Olympics is a boondoggle of cronyism, waste, misdirected tax dollars, inconvenienced local citizens, police repression, and environmental problems. Every one of them. All of the above happened in Montreal a couple years back, and I read about it only in the alternative press. The mainstream corporate press saw no evil and spoke no evil. In Sochi, though, the U.S. press reported nothing but evil. Then the U.S. finally succeeded in overthrowing the democratically elected government of Ukraine on Russia's border. Ukrainian Nazis took over the coup, and the American government and the American press immediately and repeatedly blamed Vladimir Putin for the chaos. Yes, the very villain of the Winter Olympics. Russia refuses to hand over its strategically important military and naval bases in the Crimea to the Nazi leaders of the U.S.-instigated coup in Ukraine. Imagine! So, instantly, the New York Times is publishing essays with headlines like Putin's Crimean Crime and Putin Can't Stop. You'll find both of those on the same page, even. Page A19 on March 4. A couple days earlier, they ran a story called Why Putin Doesn't Respect Us. I couldn't bring myself to read the thing, so I'll just guess that Neville Chamberlain and Munich get mentioned at least once. And if the New York Times is doing it, you can be certain that all the rest of the American press is doing likewise. This unceasing barrage of anti-Putin Cold War mongering, pretending to be news stories, has filled me with disgust. Not at Putin, but at the hopelessly corrupt U.S. corporate news media. Which is why reporter Glenn Greenwald's voice is so refreshing. He doesn't work for the U.S. corporate media, needless to say. He worked for The Guardian in England, and there he brought to light Edward Snowden's leaked documents that show the U.S. security apparatus is now tapping the phones and reading the email of every single citizen in the United States. Needless to say, for exposing the government's monstrous violation of every principle of American freedom, for exposing these crimes by the government, both Greenwald and Edward Snowden were denounced as traitors by the corporate media. Greenwald has since left The Guardian. He's founded a new internet news service, along with journalist Jeremy Scahill and filmmaker Laura Poitras. Today we'll hear parts of an interview recorded in November 2013. Here, Greenwald talks about his motivations, about Edward Snowden, about the government's war against whistleblowers, and then about the sins of the corporate-controlled news media. The interview was recorded in Greenwald's home in Rio de Janeiro, and the animal sounds in the background are his pet dogs. Here is Glenn Greenwald.
Justice Department is now preparing criminal charges against Edward Snowden. He is the former CIA employee who admits leaking secret documents that reveal government surveillance of phone records for millions of Americans.
Glenn Greenwald is the journalist responsible for releasing the information leaked by Edward Snowden.
I'm talking about Greenwald. When you have someone who's disclosed secrets like this and threatens to release more, legal action should be taken against him.
U.S. investigators are now trying to find out as much as possible about Snowden and his role in what many already consider one of the most significant intelligence leaks in American history.
The UK and US governments hate the journalism that we're doing. What they want to do is what they always try to do in these cases, which is use intimidation and bullying to scare people who are going to continue to do the reporting out of doing the reporting. And so taking my partner and putting him in a room and detaining him for what effectively was 11 hours under a terrorism law, basically branding him a terrorist, which is what they're now doing, saying that the publication of these materials is tantamount to terrorism, is a way of flaunting their power, of saying that, look at what it is that we can do to people who defy us if we choose. At the time that it happened, I was angry. I felt helpless. I was furious that they would target somebody peripheral to these events instead of me or Laura or the other journalists with whom we've been working. But at the same time, I found it incredibly emboldening because to me, they showed their true face to the world and to me about how abusive they are when it comes to the exercise of their power. And that made me know just how compelling it was to continue to bring transparency to what it is that they're doing. And it showed why they can't be trusted to exercise power without transparency and accountability. I think privacy is something that is essential to who we are as human beings and is indispensable to pretty much every other single form of human freedom and what it means to be a free, prosperous, creative human being. And the dangers of having the privacy eroded are sometimes elusive for people and yet incredibly profound. A society in which you think or know that you're always being watched is a society that will breed conformity. Because when you know that you're always being watched, as all kinds of psychological studies show, as all kinds of other social science demonstrates, when you know that you're being watched, you make choices that you believe are the ones that the judgment of society demands that you make. It's only when you can behave and choose and explore without judgmental eyes being cast upon you, that's really the realm in which dissent and creativity and exploration exclusively reside. So there are all kinds of obvious political dangers to having privacy eroded, but there are also really significant harms on the human and individual and personal level. And there aren't very many people articulating its value or defending it from erosion. And so I just perceive this need in defense of this value that I consider to be one of the most important. And then I went to George Washington University and then NYU School of Law. I think the first thing that really made me focus on political debates in a way that I had pretty much ignored for a good while I was in law school and then building my law practice, was the arrest of Jose Padilla, who was an American citizen arrested at Chicago International Airport, so on American soil, branded the dirty bomber by John Ashcroft in a hastily called press conference in Moscow, and then instead of charging him with crimes, he was declared an enemy combatant unilaterally by George Bush, and then put into a military break for 3.5 years without charges or even access to a lawyer.
They're not common criminals. They're enemy combatants and terrorists who are being detained for acts of war against our country. And that is why different rules have to apply.
Watching the United States arresting and imprisoning American citizens on U.S. soil without charges or even an access to a lawyer, and watching there be almost no backlash, no media objection, is really the first thing that kind of underscored for me how extremist things have become. And yeah, the general mindset under the war on terror that the rule of law, that constitutional constraints really are too insignificant to acknowledge is valid, and that instead the only value that matters and that trumps all others is this very narrow conception of security. And that was really the climate in which I became much more politically attentive and decided that I wanted to do more. Over time, I realized that you can only make an impact on any single political issue if you start understanding and confronting and then ultimately subverting the patterns of how media institutions function. And once I really started engaging with media institutions, it was sort of a gradual process where I started not only developing theories about how journalism should function, but then doing the kind of journalism that I thought was needed.
This is Edward Snowden.
They're going to say, you know, I've aided our enemies in making them aware of these systems. But that argument can be made against anybody who reveals.
One of the most disorienting moments I've had of my life, let alone the past 5 months, was the moment I met Snowden, because I had spent a good amount of time with him talking to him online. But I knew nothing about him demographically. I didn't know how old he was or what he looked like or much of what he had done. And for multiple reasons, my assumption was that he was in his late 50s or 60s, because he just seemed very senior in terms of his access to documents, but more importantly, the sophisticated nature of his insights. And so when I met this kid, who, although 29, looked at least 5 years younger, you know, very thin and pale and kind of wearing jeans and a t-shirt, it was shocking. It was very disorienting, because the expectation that I had of who he was going to be was so vastly different from his reality, and it made me start wondering whether this was going to be what I actually was hoping it would be. I realized that he had documents that the world should see. He had information that the public had a right to know. I was confident in the veracity of his claims and in the authenticity of his motives, and came to see that he was completely trustworthy and that I could work with him to do what journalists should do, which is inform the public about what the world's most powerful factions are doing in the dark.
Greenwald's first article revealed that, under a top secret order by a secret court, Verizon was forced to give the FBI the metadata from millions of Americans' phone calls.
In many instances, metadata is actually more invasive than listening to the content of your calls or reading your email. Metadata is the data about your communication. So instead of listening to your phone calls and hearing what you're saying in the phone call or reading your email, which is content, they will collect the information I just described. Who it is who's calling you, how often they're calling you, the duration of the call, where they are when they call you, who you're emailing, who's emailing you, what machines you're using, where you are physically when you do it. For instance, if you are a woman who is making an appointment to have an abortion, and you call an abortion clinic and someone's listening to that call, they're not going to hear anything other than, hi, I'd like to make an appointment for 2 o'clock tomorrow. If, though, that person is monitoring the metadata of the call, they will see that this woman has called an abortion clinic. Or if you're somebody with HIV and making an appointment to talk to your HIV doctor, listening to the content of the call will reveal very little. Listening, but knowing the metadata of who you're calling will reveal that you're going to see an HIV doctor. Same with human rights activists talking to informants in dangerous places. Metadata allows the government to know far more about you in many instances than even the content does. And what it also does is it enables them to create a huge picture of your life, of who your associations are, who the people that you talk to, what your network of friends is. Very, very complete picture of what your life is without having to read a single email or listen to a call.
Many people say, I don't care if my messages are being looked at. I've got nothing to hide.
So there are a lot of people who say this, but I think there are very, very, very few people who believe it. Every time somebody has said that to me, I don't really care who sees what I'm doing because I have nothing to hide, I've asked that person in probably thousands of cases now in the last year alone, please send me the passwords to all of your emails and social media accounts so that I can just troll through them at will and publish whatever it is that I want. And literally not one single person has taken me up on it. Because even though we are social creatures and political animals who need human interaction and need some sort of public identity, equally essential to who we are is a private realm. And that's always been true. Human beings have always sought out privacy. It's just intrinsic to our nature. And so I think lots of people who say that, it's something easy to say, it's sort of cute to say it, but people instinctively know that it's false, and their actions prove that.
Newspapers have revealed that the NSA has access to the central servers of 9 major internet companies through a top-secret program named PRISM. The companies include Google, Yahoo, Apple, Facebook, and 5 others.
Huge numbers of people around the world, hundreds of millions, probably billions, use Google and Yahoo for their online activities. The fact that the U.S. government is essentially breaking into the systems, the pathways in which this data is transported, which enables them to bulk vacuum all of it, shows the mindset of the NSA that they are truly interested in eliminating privacy globally, by which I mean that they want all forms of human electronic communication to be vulnerable to their surveillance net. The fact that they do this even while they have the PRISM system in place, which already enables them to acquire vast sums of information from the NSA, from the internet companies rather, from their servers, is something that just shows how extreme they become in terms of institutional devotion to gathering as much as they can.
What about the claim that this is a necessary evil because there are a lot of people plotting to attack us?
Well, first of all, we make those kind of judgments all the time. So if, for example, we installed monitors in everybody's home and authorized police to enter people's homes at will, no warrant needed, no knocking at the door, just enter in whenever you want, there's no question that crime would go way down. It would be much harder to be a rapist or a pedophile or a murderer and evade capture if there were monitors everywhere that were constantly being scrutinized and the police had the ability to just simply enter everybody's home. But we don't make that choice because we would rather have a higher risk of criminality rather than live in a society in which privacy has been completely destroyed. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is a huge amount of the spying that we're talking about has nothing to do with terrorism or national security. It has to do with economic espionage. It has to do with monitoring the population indiscriminately to augment the power of those who control the spying machine. Terrorism is the fear-mongering slogan that those in power have used over the last 12 years to engender submission to authority. It has nothing to do with the reality of why the spying program has actually been constructed, and the proof of that is that it's very rarely directed at actual terrorists and far more often than not at people who have no conceivable relations to terrorism at all. If you go and look at the debates over the Patriot Act, the people who were standing up and saying this is a radical piece of legislation, this is really dangerous, it's an abandonment of all of our values, they didn't anticipate that the Patriot Act would be used for the collection of everybody's communication. Even those people painting the grimmest and shrillest picture about what the Patriot Act would lead to were warning that it had lowered the standard too much from probable cause to just relevance, so that it would enable the government to target people too easily. But everybody assumed, even the most ardent opponents of the Patriot Act, that it was still going to be targeted investigations. Nobody ever thought the Patriot Act would be distorted and misinterpreted to authorize and justify bulk, indiscriminate, suspicionless collection of the communication data of every single American citizen as it has been. There's no question that the more you collect, the harder it is to find the things that they claim they're trying to find. So if you're collecting, as the NSA is, 1.9 billion emails and telephone calls every single day, and close to 25 billion emails and telephone calls around the world every single day, the problem that you have is that you're collecting so much that you can't even actually store it, which is why they're building this massive facility in Bluffdale, Utah, that is designed to store everything that they're collecting. It becomes increasingly difficult to find the actual terrorist attacks. The analogy they always use is looking for the needle in a haystack. The more hay you collect, the huger the haystack is, the harder it is to find the needle. That's why it's so obvious that terrorism is not the driving force behind this system.
If the motive isn't to stop terrorism, what is the motive?
If you are somebody who exercises power, and you can know everything about what everybody else is doing, what they say, what they read, what they think, what they plan, with whom they're interacting, and then at the same time build a wall of secrecy around what it is that you're doing so that nobody can actually see or know what it is that you're choosing, the power imbalance becomes amazingly acute, which is why all tyrannies instinctively use surveillance is one of their principal weapons, because the more you know about the world and about other people, the more you can manipulate and control it. The less that world knows about you, the less leverage they have over you. And so it's really at its core about simply increasing the power of the United States government vis-a-vis its own population and populations around the world.
So, is America becoming a tyranny?
I mean, I think these labels are sometimes unhelpful just because words like that are so inflammatory, and I think people are inculcated to be, they're sort of trained to believe that tyranny is something that happens in places like China and Iran and Russia and not in nice Western countries like the United States. So the minute you apply that label, people react instinctively as though you've said something radical and their brain shuts. What I can say for sure is that there are powers that are the hallmark of tyranny, one of which is mass, indiscriminate, suspicionless surveillance that the United States government is increasingly relying upon to maintain control and to shield itself from legitimate challenge. And whether somebody wants to call that tyranny or not, I'll leave that semantic debate to others, but it's that power is clearly tyrannical in nature.
In the fallout from Snowden's revelations, Brazil is now demanding an explanation over reports that the NSA monitored its citizens' phone calls and emails for a decade.
It isn't just that enemy heads of state or enemy military officials are being surveilled. It is even the democratically elected leaders of America's closest allies. We reported here that Dilma Rousseff, the president of Brazil's email accounts had been targeted for interception, that the president of Mexico, when he was running for election, had similar kind of targeting. Obviously, Angela Merkel in Germany had her cell phone for 10 years before she was even chancellor targeted and the content of those calls intercepted.
What do you make of Obama's claim that he didn't know Angela Merkel was being hacked?
It's hard to say. I don't know which is worse. I mean, if you have a program that targets the democratically elected leader of one of your closest allies, you would think that the commander-in-chief of that agency would be aware of something that significant. And if he was aware of it, as a lot of sources indicate that he was, and approved it and is now lying about it, that's obviously quite problematic. At the same time, if the agency just went off and did it on its own, which I actually believe is plausible given what a rogue agency they are, without telling Obama or the White House that it was they were doing it, they just took it on themselves to go do something that profoundly significant, that might even be more disturbing. But ultimately what it reflects is that this is a community completely out of control.
Were you shocked at the way much of the mainstream media criminalized you, like David Gregory on Meet the Press?
No, I wasn't shocked. I saw what happened with WikiLeaks when they did what the US media pretends to do and ought to do, which is bring transparency to the national security state, and watch as American journalists didn't just tolerate the idea that WikiLeaks should be criminalized for doing journalism, but led the chorus calling for Julian Assange's head. And I knew that once I started to do this reporting in the way that I intended to do it, even though I was more protective than Julian because I'm perceived as more of a journalist in the traditional sense because I worked for a large newspaper at the time, I've been writing a column for a long time, I was a lawyer before that, I'm less easily demonizable than Julian because I was born in the United States. I knew that at some point we would reach a line where American journalists would start to say this is something other than journalism. There's a big difference between rationally expecting a certain development and then viscerally living it. So if you go on Meet the Press, which is sort of the belly of the official Washington beast, it's where, you know, the most powerful Washington officials gather to disseminate their propaganda collaboratively. And to sort of be invited into that circle for the first time and then held up as this person about whom there's a debate, said David Gregory, whether or not I was even a journalist at all, and that perhaps I should be imprisoned.
To the extent that you have aided and abetted Snowden, even in his current movements, why shouldn't you, Mr. Greenwald, be charged with a crime?
To have another person who calls themselves a journalist make those kind of claims about you in a setting like that is somewhat jarring. When media figures advocate that, it's the height of hypocrisy because Washington functions almost exclusively through leaks. That's what the currency in Washington is who knows what secrets. And the people that Washington journalists idolize violate secrecy laws all the time. Bob Woodward has become the most celebrated and the richest journalist in the world by publishing book after book that contains some of America's most sensitive secrets that he just spills. And none of these journalists would ever dare suggest that Bob Woodward or his sources ought to be prosecuted. Obama aides run to the New York Times constantly and leak information about the drone program or the killing of bin Laden or a whole variety of other classified programs. When doing so, glorifies President Obama or serves his political interests. Nobody has ever suggested that those officials be prosecuted, and there are no leak investigations, serious ones, pending against the people who have done that, because leaks that serve the state, that promote the interests of those in power, are not only tolerated, but glorified in official Washington circles. The only time they get angry about leaks are leaks that undermine the interests of those in power, like the ones done by WikiLeaks, like the ones that we're doing. And what this shows is that all of these rules that official Washington claims to believe in, they don't actually believe in them. They are rules that are manipulated to promote the power of those with the greatest authority in Washington and punish those who challenge them in any way. When the New York Times in December 2005 revealed that the Bush administration had been spying on Americans and their conversations without the warrants required by the criminal law for many years, and it was subsequently revealed that the New York Times actually had learned about that 15 months earlier, but the executive editor of the New York Times, who at the time was Bill Keller, and the publisher were called into the Oval Office of the Bush White House and told by George Bush that they should suppress that story, that essentially national security would be jeopardized if they reported it. And it was, on its face, a completely ridiculous claim, the idea that national security would be jeopardized if Americans learned that they were being spied on without warrants. But the New York Times did suppress the story, let George Bush stand for re-election and get re-elected, knowing this but keeping it from their readers. And then ultimately they published it only because the reporter, Jim Rison, had lost his patience and had written a book in which he was going to break the story anyway, and the New York Times just didn't want to get scooped by their own reporter in his book. And the Times then published it and won the Pulitzer Prize for it. And that showed how the White House could take the most powerful and influential media organization in the United States, probably in the world, the New York Times, and induce them without much effort to conceal a huge major story simply by invoking this mantra of national security. And the New York Times chose to remain more loyal to the White House than to their own readers and to the country. And that really, I think, for me, underscored the hierarchy of their value system.
In time, will more people regret their condemnation of Snowden?
I think some people will. I think there are a lot of journalists in particular who simply identify overwhelmingly with the state. And so anybody who takes action that undermines the interest of those in power within the state apparatus is somebody who will be viewed as a villain with hostility by those journalists, which is ironic given that that's the role that journalists are actually supposed to play. So I don't think those kinds of journalists, like a David Brooks or David Gregory or Bob Schaefer, the kind of like journalists who are basically just mouthpieces of political power, will ever come to change their minds. But I do think a lot of people, as these revelations have emerged, have come to see that there really is this system that is extremely menacing and that they ought to have known about, and understand that the only reason they now know about it is because of Edward Snowden's courage and sacrifice.
Journalist Glenn Greenwald. That's taken from an interview by the Canadian magazine Vice in November 2013. You've been listening to New World Notes, and you can listen again at our free archive of past shows. You'll find that and more at our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimi non carborundum, and reminding you that you're not crazy, the system is. Catch you next week, and ciao.